Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I don't think we're on the same frequency exactly here. The event, first of all, to come up with a random number for this event, the event has to have taken place many, many times. Otherwise, you really can't do that. I don't know if they've had enough asteroids striking the Earth to actually set up. I mean, you could say, okay, if we've had 3 asteroids strike the Earth in 50 million years, then you're going to make the argument approximately, you know, every so many million years we're going to have an asteroid strike. That's not a good way to do it. If you've had 1,000 asteroids striking the Earth in 50 million years, then you start to get up a little closer on the numbers. And if you, especially if you don't notice them bunching up near the beginning or bunching up near the end, if you notice them being somewhat evenly distributed, not exactly, but somewhat evenly distributed, I think you're starting to be able to predict these events. And what I'm saying now is, if, let's say, every 1,000 years a big asteroid was to strike the Earth, and we've had 1,000 asteroid strikes now, to make that analogy, to come up with that number, now, if we've gone 2 event times and nothing has happened, I say it's really time to worry, because the numbers are speaking against you. That seems to be a force which works even in the stock market. In other words, when something is supposed to happen and it's long overdue and it's happened thousands of times, it's like saying, I have bought a 12 million lottery tickets. What are the odds that any one of those is going to be the winner? Well, the answer is 1 out of 12 million. So if I get to 12 million and I don't hit it, I should expect, even if I'm not a good guesser, if I buy all the wrong numbers, I would kind of expect the next lottery ticket to be darn close to be the winner.
You can predict the probability of winning the lottery if you know the percentage of the tickets total that you bought. If they issue 1 million tickets and you bought 500,000 tickets, you got a 50% probability of winning. Number of favorable events divided by the number of events is one of the definitions of the prediction of probability. In the case of the stock market, you got to be careful, because the stock market is not a random event. It's not a predictable event, but it's caused by human beings and their confidence. The crash of 1929 occurred because human beings lost confidence and they said, I think a crash is going to happen. I want to get my money out before it happens. I don't want to be hit by this. A hell of a lot of people came to the exact same opinion at the exact same time, and that created the crash. The possibility exists that somebody writing a particular article in the newspaper that happened to hit resonance with a lot of people who were into the market created the crash. Well, there's another thing that was creating the crash. A hell of a lot of people were suddenly overly enthusiastic about the market, and they were buying stock with money they didn't own. They would go and get the biggest possible loan, hock all of their assets, and buy everything in stock that they could, and they were gambling with money they didn't own. And that gave them a real lack of confidence. When people have enough confidence and get a little bit of a dip in the market, they say, hey, that's not significant. A person I know who is pretty smart in the market says the following. Most of the time, the gains are permanent and the losses are temporary. If you're a long-term investor in the market, and if you're sufficiently diversified with a little bit of intelligence in the stuff that you buy, you're going to get something like 8% profit per year, on average. There is no bank that's going to give you that much interest today. So if you're a long-term investor, you're better off in the market. And if you're a long-term investor, you don't worry about the dip that occurs for a particular month. You worry about the dip that's going to happen for a couple of years around the time that you really retire and you really want the money. And dips that occur for a couple of years are very rare events. Dips are usually pretty brief, and the climbs of the market usually last for quite a few years. So it's an extremely good investment, as long as everybody has confidence. Well, now there are rules and regulations that won't let you have $5,000 of real money, borrow $500,000, and invest $500,000 in the stock market. There are checks and balances that won't allow you to do that today. People were doing that in 1929, and they had zero confidence in what they were doing. That's some of what was going on there. What you're discussing, Barry, is called confidence level. If you gather enough data and you see a pattern and a regularity to it, and you can measure the standard deviation, the mean value, the standard deviation, the first, second, and third moment, you measure all the statistics of your gathered data. As you gather more and more data of a particular kind of event, you get a higher and higher confidence level, and that predicts your accuracy, let's say, about your future predictions. Statistics will let you do that to a degree, but depending on how random the event really is, you can't take that too far. You can't take, you can gather all the statistics you want for years on end on a truly fair roulette wheel. That's not going to allow you to predict how to earn a lot of money playing roulette. As long as somebody's not fudging with the roulette wheel, and if there's, I don't know what the number is, maybe there's 120 spaces on that wheel. All you can predict is that each one of those spaces have a probability of one chance in 120 of coming up on each individual roll. Now, there are people who are very smart at counting cards, and when they play blackjack, and as the deck becomes older and older, with their card counting techniques, they can shift the statistics in their favor, and they start winning more and more hands of blackjack. The rate of winning is very slow. They got to stay there for days on end to make a few thousand dollars, unless they're using a computer. And if you're using a computer and the casino knows about it, they're going to plaster your picture all over the place, and nowhere in the United States are you going to be allowed into a casino. N2MB, K2RIW.
Okay, if there's 120 individual pegs on the roulette wheel, and you're saying it's the chances of 1 in 120 that you'll strike that number. So if you have used a particular number, and it's now 130 times that number hasn't come up, you're saying, and I agree with you, that there's no particular reason for that number to come up. But statistically, it probably will.
No. I don't care if black number one came up five times in a row, and if it's a truly fair roulette wheel, the sixth time is only one chance in 120. By the same token, if the black number one has not come up in the last 500 rolls, that doesn't mean there is any difference from one chance in 120 for coming up the next time. So in a case of a truly fair roulette wheel used with no bias, every single roll of every single number is one chance in 120 in our particular example. So unless somebody is fudging with that roulette wheel, that is a truly random event. And I got to be a little careful how I say that, because if you have enough knowledge, nothing is random. If you have the knowledge of a deity, of how fast the roulette wheel is spinning, what number just passed the guy's hand as he spun it, and exactly how much velocity he issued into the ball as he starts spinning it around the edge of that roulette wheel. If you had enough knowledge, what's going to happen is predictable. But none of us have that knowledge. If the guy running the wheel is truly fair and not biasing in any way, and it's a truly fair wheel, every single number has exactly one chance in 120 in our example. And regardless of the previous event, nothing changes it if it's truly fair. Now, there are a hell of a lot of other things in life that are nowhere near that random. But that, as an example, is a pretty darn random event. And by the way, part of the randomness is because a human being is spinning the wheel and a human being is launching the ball. If you had a machine spinning the wheel and a machine launching the ball, because the machine is capable of doing those two events with extreme precision, the possibility exists that you could take out a large percentage of the randomness. Back to you, Barry. KQRIW.
Okay, I don't want to keep the whole net waiting on this one, but if we did one more thing, we wrote on a piece of paper, every time you spun that wheel, you wrote down what number you got. Would you agree with me that after you, if you were through spinning this thing for a million times, that every number on that paper would come up at approximately the same amount? Would you agree with that?
If it is a truly fair roulette wheel being used in a truly random manner by a unbiased human being, the answer is yes, yes.
Okay, and that's my argument, because when you see this thing written out on a piece of paper, and you see that one came up 100 times, and two came up 99 times, or I should say 199, you know, almost 100 times, and the next one, they should average out to be darn, darn close. And if one is falling behind, I would say that there's a good argument that that number is going to come up soon, so it doesn't fall behind. Now, there's nothing in nature that we're saying that's doing this. I mean, yeah, I understand a human being is doing this, and it's very random because the person's doing this, and because his force is changing, and where he starts is changing. There's no predictability on that. But on the average, these things should, and probably do, come up in very nice order if you do this enough times.
Yeah. Doing it enough time and gathering the statistics is called the central limit theorem. That's one of the subsets of the central limit theorem, that it will behave as you described. If you gather enough data, you will really determine the probability of each one of those numbers. And if, and maybe enough data is 10 million rolls of this roulette wheel, assuming it's going to last that long and you're going to last that long. When you start gathering small amounts of statistics, you only roll the wheel 100 times, and you try to measure its fairness, that's nowhere near enough data. You roll it some number of millions of times, and if each one of those numbers don't come up over with a percentage of 1 over the total number of positions, if you start getting a different number, you may discover that there's an extra padded piece of paper on the black one, and the ball sticks there a little bit more easily. And there's something unfair about the roulette table is what you're probably discovering. Or there's something not random in the way it's being used. But I will admit, what you're saying, Barry, is that if you gather the data zillions of times and you discover that the roulette table is truly fair, and if in the next 100 rolls you discover a particular number is slightly behind schedule, your faith, and I'm using the word faith in quotes, tells you that you should put your money on that number because it's likely to come up. On the assumption you truly knew that the table was fair, a mathematician will tell you, Barry, you're wasting your money. And by the way, a smart mathematician, will tell you, when you walk through the front door of a gambling casino, since every one of those games has a certain percentage in favor of the house, and you walk into a place like Foxwoods, and you look at the plushness of that place, and you look at the 200 megabucks that flows through there per 6 months or whatever it is, you soon realize who is paying for that. People who want to believe they are lucky, whatever the heck that means. In my opinion, it's a fool's game, but that's an opinion. For people who truly believe they're lucky, in most cases, I think they're foolish. I think there is no luck. There is no random event. The percentage that each one of those games is in favor of the house is closely regulated, closely controlled, very predictable. Within a very small percentage, they know exactly how much profit they're going to get per year. They know exactly how many dollars they're going to hand to the state of Connecticut. No questions asked. Back to you, Barry, KQRIW.
Oh, I agree with that. I don't gamble at all. Okay, I'm going to let, I guess it was Mel that was actually, I was interfering with at this point, so I'm going to turn it back over to him. I will take this a few notches further, probably next week if I get back in here, but you almost contradicted yourself along the way. We won't go into that now. I don't want to do that now. I know where you're coming from, and I believe what you're saying. Logically, it all sounds right, but there's a problem with it, and we'll get into that on another day, on another night. I'd like to do this a little further. K2RIW to pick it up, and the group, and 2MB.
Yeah, this sounds like it's a discussion that's off subject, and it's about gambling. But it really is statistics, accuracy. It affects what happens with a rubidium oscillator, a cesium beam oscillator, any of our atomic clocks. The atomic clocks are chosen because they have beautiful long-term accuracy. They happen to have terrible short-term accuracy, but a good crystal oscillator has good short-term accuracy. So when you use the rubidium and cesium to give what they call disciplining to the crystal oscillator, you end up with a system that has the best of both worlds, extremely good short-term stability and extremely good long-term stability, and it's now significantly more stable than the hold-on rotation of the Earth. You could say the Earth is a very large, massive object that's freely floating in the best vacuum of space there is, except for the solar wind that's hitting it from time to time. And it's a very large gyroscope spinning very precisely. And until not too many years ago, it was the most precise thing we could lay our hands on, so to speak. And all of a sudden, our electronic atomic oscillators turned out to be a hell of a lot more accurate. And proving that, by the way, is very difficult. The only way you can prove how good an oscillator is called the Allen paired variance technique. You build an identical pair of oscillators, and you beat one against the other over a long period of time. That's how you measure the accuracy of your oscillator. Because back before you had something you knew was extremely good, like rubidium and cesium, before you knew that, somebody comes through the door of the National Bureau of Standards and says, I've just invented an oscillator. It's better than anything you got. To which you as the technician there would say, okay, prove it. And how do you prove it? The best proof you know is to build a pair of them and compare them against each other. It sounds like a bootstrapping operation, but that's literally what's done. K2KEY, go ahead with another antenna question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dub, thanks, Dave, for a quick comment on the oscillating.
Okay, Paul and another person. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, don't they want to eventually use pulse laws for keeping time? I think I read that not too long ago, where they want to switch from rubidium to the pulse laws, because they're supposed to be more accurate over a longer period of time.
Negatory. That was a proposal, Paul. Everyone used to believe that pulsars were extremely accurate. Pulsars do slowly decrease in velocity. That's a predictable amount. Every so often, they make a sudden jump in the rotational speed. The best guess as to what's going on is the pulsar is an extremely high gravity, dense object spinning very rapidly. Every so often, the individual plates shift a little bit, and the hold-on star settles to a slightly smaller diameter, and it spins more rapidly. When you look at the spin of a pulsar, and they've studied a number of them for long periods of time, you see a continuous slow decrease. All of a sudden, you see it make a jump upward again in frequency. That's because it settled to a slightly smaller diameter, and it's like a ice skater who's spinning and brings his arms in. When he brings in his arms, and you have conservation of rotational energy, and you're decreasing the moment of inertia by lowering the distance your arms are sticking out there, the ice skater spins faster. Well, that's happening to the pulsars. So if you had a way of predicting how often the pulsar is going to have a quake like that, yeah, it would make a good oscillator, but that's, to us, a very unpredictable event. To my knowledge, nobody has topped cesium at this time, Paul. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. I'll cross that off my mental list. I know there was talk of that. Very good, Dick Mackey.
Was there another person? Okay, I guess it was just him. Hit us with another antenna question, Mel.
Okay. Pause just to make sure that nobody else wants to make a comment. All right, let's see. Get back to the realm of amateur radio. Let's see. Oh, okay, here's one from a young person. I just got my ham license. I'm 14 years old. Okay, congratulations. And I'm putting up a, planning to put up a dipole. I am very fascinated, though I did not learn CW, but I'd like to learn CW, and I want to put up a dipole and get on CW. If I was able to get a small transmitter that was used many years ago by a relative for CW only. Okay, that sounds great. That's encouraging. However, I need some wire for my dipole. I have some copper wire. Will that be adequate? Yes. However, oh, the feed line. All right, here's the, crux of the, I'm trying to, discern what it's all about. My friend's father says he has a roll of RG8U coax in the garage for many years, and he says I can roll off what I need. I need about 75 feet. Is there a way I can determine if the coax cable is still usable by a simple method rather than hooking it up, putting it up at the antenna? Testing the coax before I put it up at the antenna. I do have an SWR bridge and a handheld antenna analyzer available. Oh, available. Okay. So that's the question. I'm sure we can easily give an answer to that, Dick. Over.
Yeah, that's a beauty. When it comes to the wire of the antenna itself, a hell of a lot of people put up their very first dipole by using household wiring. 14-gauge, 16-gauge, 12-gauge household wiring, with or without the rubber run board. There's advantages and disadvantages of each. But household copper wire makes very good antenna wire. And the guys who put up antennas that they're trying to make them secret will use very fine wire, like 30-gauge enameled wire, which is a bit thicker than hair, but becomes very invisible when you're more than 10 feet away from it. So the dipole itself, on most of these HF bands, 80 to 10 meters, 30-gauge wire will give you 90% of the performance. Even though it's a little bit thinner and has a little bit more resistance, it will still work. So the wire itself is not critical. The coax cable, there has been stories of World War II coax cable which had a contaminating characteristic. That means before they learned a lot about the chemistry, right around 1945, people were making RG8 cable, and the outer rubber jacket was using some kind of a polymer which leached a fluid into the polyethylene dielectric. That's the plastic that's in between the outer braid and the inner center conductor. It leached some kind of a chemical that contaminated it, and the net result was the cable had a lot higher loss than you'd like it to have. I think almost all the coax cable invented, manufactured since, I'm going to say 1950, 1953, somewhere around there, I think they had solved the contaminating problem. The next thing to worry about is if that roll of coax cable was left in the basement or left in the garage and it was under a pool of water for a while, and it may have sucked up a lot of water. Unlikely. You could give it a couple of very simple tests, and that is with an ohm meter, you could measure braid at one end to braid at the other end, and you should get a very small fraction of 1 ohm. You could measure semiconductor at one end to semiconductor at the other end. You should get a very small fraction of 1 ohm. You could measure from semiconductor to braid, and you should get a very large number of megohms of resistance, telling you that there isn't any water in there. So water that's soaked into the cable sometimes will show up as failing the ohmmeter test, where instead of it being many megohms from semiconductor to shield, it might measure numbers like 1 megohm or 0.5 megohm. You should be very suspicious when you see that. The next thing is a little bit more subtle. There are ways that the water can soak into the foam of a cable or into the polyethylene so that It doesn't go all the way through. It doesn't complete the circuit between semiconductor and outer shield, and it might not show up on the ohmmeter. The ohmmeter test is a necessary but not perfectly sufficient. If you fail the ohmmeter test, you're in a fair amount of trouble with that cable. If you pass the ohmmeter test, 90-some-odd% of the time, you're in good shape. The next thing you can do is to really measure the insertion loss of your cable, even before you put it up. One way is to connect a transmitter of any power level that you can measure. I don't care if it's a milliwatt, a watt, or 100 watts. You connect a source of signal to one end and measure what comes out the other end. You first measure what's coming out of your transmitter, and if your sensing device says, yes, 1 watt is coming out of the transmitter, and now you put the 1 watt through 100 feet of cable, and at the other end of the cable you get 0.95 watts, that's a pretty good test. Now, if you don't have a power sensing device, you can do a not quite as accurate test, but a pretty good test with something that can measure standing wave ratio. And the way you would do that is you connect your source of signal through the standing wave ratio measuring device into the cable. At the far end of the cable, it would be very nice if you had a known good 50-ohm load. And you connect that load, and you measure with your standing wave ratio meter something very low, like a 1.03 standing wave ratio, with the dummy load connected, a known good dummy load. You then disconnect the dummy load so that now you know you've got an open circuit at the far end. Or if you think you can generate a good short circuit, a very good radio short circuit, and I'll discuss that a little later, you can put a short circuit again. But by one means or another, you create a perfect open or a nearly perfect short at the far end. Now you know the 1 watt that you're sending down the cable is going to go into an open circuit. The magic of transmission lines is that if they see a perfect mismatch, no energy continues in that direction. It all reflects back. And then you measure the percentage that comes back. You can measure the percentage that comes back with a Bird wattmeter, measure forward power and reverse power at the transmitter with the open circuited length of cable. And now whatever insertion loss you measure, divide it by two, because the signal has been down the cable twice. Once down to the open circuit where it reflected and came back. If you measured 1 dB of loss in the signal that went down and came back, because it went through the cable twice, you divide that by two, your cable's got 0.5 dB of loss. And in most cases, that's very good cable. And your now question is going to be, what's a good number? Well, it depends on what you're doing. If I'm trying to run a coax cable up my 100 feet of tower, and I'm doing it at 10 gigahertz, and I've got a very high quality piece of cable, and I've got 7 decibels of loss, at 10,000 megacycles, that's extremely good. I may not be happy with it, but that's the laws of physics. Unless I'm going to go out and buy a much better piece of waveguide, I've got to suffer that amount of loss. Whereas a guy on 80 meters with a piece of RG8 cable, his definition of success is he would like to have a small fraction of 1 decibel of loss down the cable. Even if he had the 7 dB of loss of my example, that doesn't mean his antenna is not going to work. It just means that he thinks he's got a 100-watt transmitter, and the guy listening to him is going to say, you sound like a 45-watt transmitter. That's not bad. There's a hell of a lot of people out there who do low-power transmitter work, QRP they call it, and they never transmit more than a couple of watts, and they make a lot of QSOs. So the main reason you measure the cable is not necessarily a go-no-go test. It's to let you know where you are. If you find out that your piece of cable, according to the manufacturer's spec, at your particular frequency should have a 0.5 dB of loss, and your piece of cable has 7 decibels of loss, it's not a showstopper. It's an annoyance. And if you're a little short on shekels this particular week, you sew up that piece of cable, and you know in the back of your mind, the next time you get paid on your paper route, a couple of weeks from now, you might decide to go out and buy a better piece of cable. And if you measure 0.5 dB of loss, you know the cable is good enough, and you put your money somewhere else. So the information is not necessarily no-go. It gives you the information to know what you should do next and where the weakness in your system is, if you care. And if you're a serious operator and you're skilled enough, even though you're using defective equipment that's putting out 45 watts instead of 100 watts, that's not going to stop you from making contacts. It just means you're not going to be heard quite as well in that pileup when you try to talk to that DX station. But it's nice to know what's happening. And we amateurs just love using instrumentation to make measurements to find out what Mother Nature's laws of physics are doing to us today. And with the stuff that's been made available to us, we'd like to know, is it high quality, low quality, medium quality? If it's high quality, you leave it alone. If it's low quality, you consider replacing it when you got the resources to do that. That's the philosophy. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Come here, I have to sum it up for this young person. Do like Dick Kurtz said, do the measurements with your VOM, both old meter. And then what you can do, you said you had the availability of a handheld antenna analyzer. So what you do is take your handheld antenna analyzer, go over that dummy load that you're going to use. You can use a resistor, 50 ohm resistor, 200 ohm resistor in parallel. Make a measurement with it. Observe what you see on the handheld antenna analyzer. Then without touching anything on the handheld antenna analyzer as far as frequency goes, you know the frequency you're going to operate on, HF. I believe it's said, I think it said 40 meters. So, okay, leave it on that frequency. Put the dummy load on one end of the cable. Go to the other end of the cable with the handheld antenna analyzer. As I said, don't touch any adjustments. And compare the readings, and it should be extremely close. Like Dick said, don't split hairs. It doesn't mean anything. A little difference this way or that way. I think that's the simplest way to determine, basically, especially if you're going to operate like 40 E to 7 megahertz, I think that should be a sufficient enough test for it to take over.
Yeah, I like your method. Your method is to use the analyzer on the input end of the cable with the output end on a dummy load and see what the analyzer says, then move the analyzer downrange to the output end, put it in between the cable and the dummy load at the output end, and see what its forward power measures. That's a better test. The other test, you can make a measurement with this open and dummy load from the shack, so to speak, never moving the antenna analyzer. That's the second method of using it. But you got to be a little bit careful there, because the thing I forgot to tell you is that when you go from the dummy load on the far end of the cable to a short circuit or an open circuit, in other words, you're intentionally making a complete reflection at the far end, so you measure the insertion loss of the cable twice, out and back. You got to be careful that you may have to readjust the forward power reading, the so-called calibration reading, on the antenna analyzer. The reason for that, and maybe it's a standing wave ratio meter, maybe it's a bird watt meter, but you have to readjust either your thinking or the settings, because when the transmitter was looking into the cable, into the dummy load, the transmitter saw 50 ohm and it made, let's assume, 1 watt of output. When the transmitter now looks into an open circuit, it's in general going to generate a different amount of power. So the transmitter goes up and down in apparent power output when it sees a different impedance. And therefore it requires either a new calibration or a new writing down of the forward and reverse numbers, if you know what I mean. You have to recognize the fact that the power output of the transmitter is impedance sensitive. Whereas with Mel's technique of putting the antenna analyzer on the input end of the cable with the far end terminated, and then move the antenna analyzer to the output end of the cable with the network analyzer, antenna analyzer terminated, that's a better test. Now the transmitter sees the constant impedance all the time, and as long as the network the antenna analyzer has got the right kind of sensitivity to it, that's going to be a direct reading, no mathematics required. Back to you, Mel. I like that test.
Yeah, Roger, simple test, you know. It'll give them a go, no go. I'm saying, you know, like you said, the cable 10 years old, so laying in a garage, I would assume it wasn't in the floods or anything like that. So, in fact, when you strip open the ends of the cable, if you see corroded braid, in fact, when the braid gets corroded, you won't be able to solder to it. It's illegal. It'll be deteriorated, that it literally will... I've seen when I open it up, it actually was powder, actually was so deteriorated, actually shake it out. So if the braid is nice and shiny, copper-colored braid, I would say that cable was stored fairly decent Usually I, you'll find, like I say, the cable, the braid turns a greenish color. The water had got into the cable and it's falling apart. So with that, I think should be sufficient enough to test that, fix this, analyze, and the method of using that handheld analog should no more than be sufficient for whatever you're going to do. See what your name Joseph. Okay, good luck with it, Joseph. All right, Dick, you want another one?
KC2MPY.
Fire away, and MPY first. Go ahead and start off with your name, MPY.
Dick, this is Charlie again, KC2MPY. While you've been conducting the TechNet, and I've been listening to it in the background, I've been climbing up and down here like a madman, and I put that beam antenna up, and I now have my answer that we talked about earlier. Using your signal into the input as a test, my J-pole, I get you about S2. With the beam, I get you at S6. So something's working.
Hey, Joe, that thing, Charlie, that thing is flying. As long as your S-meter is well calibrated. S2 to S6. If your S-meter was properly calibrated, that's four S-units. Each S-unit is supposed to be 6 dB. That's 24 dB of improvement. Of course, that's crazy. The majority of S-meters these days are very liberal. They read a little bit too high, if you know what I mean. But it's certainly in the right direction. Sounds to me like you've got an antenna. Out of curiosity, is the altitude of your J-pole and the altitude of the Yagi at all similar? Back to you, Charlie.
No, the J-pole is 10 feet higher, to be exact. This is up 20 feet to the center of the boom, and the J-pole is up just about 28 feet to the base of the J-pole, plus the height of the J-pole. So yeah, the numbers are too high, but they are that exactly, because obviously this is a 706, and I know the S-meters can't be too calibrated, but it's clear that when I aim it towards you, I've got you right at a solid 6. When I go to the J-pole, you're down to a 2. When I spin the beam around away from you, I can't hear anything whatsoever from you at all. You disappear completely. I don't get any signal at all on the input. And I've been doing that with the other stations that have been on, too, with Mel, and I get about the same answer. So it's pretty interesting that this thing actually does work.
Yeah, I'm listening to you on the input. And how many watts are you running? You're giving me a fair amount of signal. Go ahead.
I guess I got this thing at about 6 on the scale. I don't know if that's calibrated, if you can believe it or not. So it can't be much, probably 30 watts or something like that. But I'm not facing towards you. In fact, I'll turn it towards you because I had turned it towards the repeater from me. But I'll turn it in your direction as we speak, where I've gotten you on the highest signal. And basically, even though I haven't had a chance to calibrate this, the direction, it basically seems to be east of me, maybe, or a little bit slightly northeast, maybe.
Yeah, you went from an S2 to an S7 as you rotated that. That's got a very nice, clean pattern. You got it made, Joe. Charlie.
Yeah, well, that's really good. I'm glad to hear that. So the copper tubing plumber's nightmare works. It's a little heavy, but it certainly is easy to slap together some quarter-inch copper tubing and some three-quarter-inch copper tubing to make one of these things.
Okay, I'm guessing the three-quarter-inch is the boom and the one-quarter-inch is the element. How are you connecting them together?
I straight drilled through the boom for all the elements are completely drilled straight through, and I just soldered them in. And that's it. And I've mounted the coax through the center of the tubing, so it comes out the end, and it's mounted in a cantilever style at the end, so that the cable wouldn't hang down. I figured that would be about the best I could do.
Pretty crazy. It's a little bit heavy antenna, but Plumber's Delight, I guess they call it. And where you're soldering the elements to the boom, the quarter-inch diameter elements to the 3/4 inch diameter boom. That gives you a nice attachment technique that's not going to change in characteristics. The antenna will become a little bit homely looking as the copper becomes corroded and with copper oxide. If you cleaned it up with Scotch-Brite, I don't recommend you use steel wool, I recommend you use Scotch-Brite. If you shined up the copper and then sprayed it with something like Krylon, but a better substance is the clear spray of, can't think of the name of the company, that makes spray in cans. Galvanized spray and all other kinds of paint cans. I can't think of the brand name of that company.
Rust-Oleum.
Rust-Oleum, yeah. Rust-Oleum makes a clear spray that's ultraviolet protected. It's quite a bit better than Krylon. You spray it with Rust-Oleum Clear, or any other color you like, and the copper will not show tarnishing anywhere near as fast. And now we're talking about aesthetics. We're not talking about performance. But it's nice to have the antenna look good. And so you built, what, 4, 5, or 6 elements of that style, Charlie?
This is 4 elements. This was my first try at it, so I figured I'd stay with something that was going to be relatively easy to handle. So I said, instead of doing anything bigger, and it would get too heavy probably, I figured I would use just 4 to see if it would work. And my J-pole is another plumber's delight that's been up there 3 years now, and that thing has discolored, and it is really dark and miserable looking. Still appears to work fairly well. And that was going to be my next question, but you answered it, that it's strictly aesthetics. And so that thing's been up there a long time, and every joint is soldered. I mean, it's just nice. I just like the idea of having a DC ground into my ground rods, just for lightning purposes. I really wouldn't like to see lightning down these cables. So I've got some reasonably heavy ground setups here, so I like to stay with DC grounded antennas.
Yeah, when it comes to the copper oxide on an antenna on 2 meters, it would be extremely difficult to measure the detriment the copper oxide creates. Very similar to guys who will frequently ask us the question, Mel and I get asked, if I use 14-gauge house wire, and if I leave the rubber insulation on or take the rubber insulation off, will it change the tuning of the antenna? And the answer is 99.9% no. Is there a delta? Yeah, it's extremely small. And the only place where that delta has ever shown up to be significant is in the square loop Yagis, the Quaggies, as they used to be called, in the middle 70s or 80s, K6, it wasn't MYC. Can't think of the guy's call letters right now, but a guy in the Los Angeles area made this particular square loop Yagi. It was a regular Yagi, except the driven element was a square loop, and he made it out of 14-gauge household wire. And he used a certain American product with a certain thickness of rubber, and when the Germans used their equivalent of millimeter-gauge wire with a different kind of rubber outside, the driven element ended up on the wrong frequency. Not a whole lot wrong, but enough that it gave them a significant amount of standing wave ratio, and they thought it was a poorly matched antenna. It was a European versus American materials problem on the driven element. There, the rubber did make a difference, but on an ordinary dipole, it does not. The RF energy goes down through the rubber until it sees the metal and says, aha, I'm going to do my thing. Everything else is an insulator, and the difference is extremely small. And by the same token, at your frequencies, the copper oxide probably has a thickness of 1/100,000th of an inch, and it's not there. If you were doing a cavity filter experiment at 10,000 megacycles, and you compared a silver-plated, properly silver-plated cavity to one with a lot of copper oxide, there would be a measurable difference in the performance of that cavity. But at 146 megacycles, not to worry. Sounds like you got a darn good antenna. Sounds like a first light, as they say in the telescope world, occurred on the TechNet. Congratulations. Back to you, Charlie.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I'm pretty glad it works well, and I appreciate all the help. And everything I've done here is from all the years of listening in the background to the TechNet. It's been really helpful. I mean, everything I've done here is a result of listening to you talk and Mel over the years. So I'll let you get on with it, and I'll be standing on the side, KC2MTY.
Mel, did you hear those words? Mel, you know now, we've been thinking about who we should send the bill to. There's a possible candidate to send the first bill to, K2KEY, K2RIW.
I can say we're recording it, so we've got it. That's official. Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I built the same version of an antenna, but a 6 meter, also out of copper pipe that I bought. I was able to find short length, just what I needed. You know, they have a whole barrel full of them at Home Depot. You should get the end with the plumbing suppliers. And I was just happened to go by there, and I saw all kinds of lengths of pieces that cut off. You can buy them fairly cheap. That, you know, people come in, want a 3 foot length, and then they got the rest of it left over, so they sold out those pieces all separate. So I built the 6 meter beam. I also built a vertical, a collapsible vertical, also out of that copper pipe. I call those antennas my Home Depot antennas. Except what I did, Dick, I sprayed the antennas with aluminum paint, made them look like they're made out of aluminum. Took a can of Krylon aluminum paint and just sprayed them over. So now they're aluminum colored, Dick, over.
Yeah, I think that's an easier way to go because my favorite material to make antennas out of is aluminum. 6061 T6 alloy aluminum has extremely good characteristics on surviving the weather, not tarnishing very much, looking good 10 years downrange, and is nice and light and strong. So it meets all the criteria. That's the good news. The bad news is making electrical contact with the aluminum is a little bit of a pain. Now, if you feed the elements through the boom, there's no good way you can do aluminum soldering, so to speak. So the elements through the boom are eventually going to make a break in contact because of aluminum oxide buildup, and therefore they tune themselves to another frequency. So the right way to do it with aluminum elements is to find some way of mounting the elements on top, on little saddles or in plastic blocks or whatever. The so-called insulated Yagi is something I had a lot to do with way back in the 70s. And that way you can stop the elements from, the parasitic elements from changing characteristics. The driven element, I still make it out of brass or copper so you can easily solder to it in order to make a folded dipole or whatever your favorite method of feeding the driven element is concerned. But when it comes to significantly long antennas, I strongly favor aluminum over copper. Copper does the job beautifully, just that it's a little bit heavy. Back to you, Mel.
Well, I could say for 2 meters, 6 meter beams, my 6 meter beam only has three elements, 6 meter beam. And the 2 meter beam, I happen to build that one, that 12 element, that also they give you, you know, they give you that chart in the ARRL antenna manual. And so I built, the one I built for 2 meters, what I got was my brother when he was in the scrap business. I said, save me all those stainless steel antennas that used to be on cars. You remember, it screwed right on, had a quarter 20 thread at the end, and they screwed right on. You know, they were used as the broadcast antenna, a length of stainless steel rod. So he brought me a pile of them. The day that car came in, he saw it. He said, my brother needs it for something, some kind of antenna. He unscrewed those. And I made them. I used those back-to-back, made little blocks in the middle, and so I constructed the 2 meter version with those stainless steel rods stick over.
That's a good way to go, except that it's a little bit heavy. So the good news is that there's no tarnishing, but the way the elements go through the boom with stainless steel would be a little bit of a problem depending on how you mount them. And again, I recommend the driven element be brass or copper or something that's solder or a bolt. There are ways of doing it with aluminum, and that is if you're building a folded dipole where you've got metal clips going way out at the tips of the antenna is where you make contact on the feed assembly. There the voltage is so high, the impedance is so high, that you don't need milliohms of contact. In fact, there are ways you could feed a folded dipole by having metal clips touching the driven element out of the tip in a capacitive manner. You could have a layer of Teflon tape wrapped around the element and a metal clip over top of the Teflon tape, and that goes to the driven element assembly, if you know what I mean, the folded dipole or T-match, I guess you would call it a T-match. The feeding assembly could be fed through capacitors and therefore there'd be no aluminum oxide building up changing the contact. There would be nothing but a pure capacitance of the Teflon tape out there, and in theory that's not going to change in time. Although I'd worry a little bit about water getting in there and changing the capacitance. No, I wouldn't worry about that, because with any reasonable amount of capacitance out there through the Teflon tape, because the impedance out there is so high, thousands of ohms, that the capacitance can't be degraded by water, if you know what I mean. In other words, the voltage drop across that capacitor would be near zero because the impedance is so high. Lots of ways of doing it. So my favorite material is aluminum. The guys in the Mojave Desert like building antennas out of bamboo and wooden slats and things like that, where they get no water in their environment. That works very well. We have a significant amount of humidity and salt spray and everything else here on Long Island, and I don't recommend those particular materials. Aluminum is my favorite. Copper is my second favorite. Back to you, Mel, KQRIW.
Next time. Well, the one I built for 2 meters is got the elements out of stainless steel sit on top of their insulator from the boom, and they screw into the plastic pieces of plastic. It was, like I say, described in the boom. However, on this on the 2 meter beam is aluminum. Salvage material, you know, I'm a typical ham, always looking around for pieces of something. Every piece of pipe I see in the street or whatever, I think of something, I'll make use of it. I used to bring home tons of that stuff, because every job I went to, I'd find a piece of conduit, a piece of copper, pipe to this or something, or God knows what I found. Every day I came home with a trunk load of something or another, eventually I had to stop that because I'd need a warehouse if I continued at that rate, Dick. All kinds of real nice stuff, shame to throw it away type stuff. Okay, anyhow, would you like to continue, or you've had enough for tonight, over?
Go ahead and choose another one.
Okay, let's see. Let's look down the list here. I picked out one here. Oh, here's another young fella. As you guys were discussing upper limits about a week ago, okay, and you mentioned that there are hams doing experiments at as high as 300 gigahertz. 300 gigahertz. That's, yeah, 300,000 megahertz, right. That is correct. You said 300,000 megahertz, and I said that is correct. And the 300 gigahertz is so-called the highest band of amateur radio. I understand that there's also a way you can do this instead of RF work, do it with light wave laser communication. Is this really possible, over?
Yay, verily. My buddies in the Dallas, Texas area, I don't know if they still do, but a few years ago they held the laser communication distance record from one mountain in the Dallas area to another mountain, I think in southern Oklahoma. 154 miles, is my memory, was the QSO they made with laser diodes. They were using a telescope as the receiver, with the laser detector was connected to the eyepiece, and the transmitter was another small type of a telescope. So two telescopes side by side, strapped together, was the transmitter receiver. And, okay, was that RF, was that laser, was that light, and is there a difference? And that's now into an area of semantics. I can start off at extremely low frequencies, like audio, and like 60 cycles from Con Ed and LIPA. And yes, the signal is slowing down the power lines and the transmission lines and the distribution lines of Con Ed and LIPA. Is it transmitting a 60 hertz wave into the atmosphere? Absolutely. Now, the 60 hertz wave is a little bit hard to listen to. It's not easy to build an antenna for it, and it's not easy to communicate with it, but that's the signal. That's a real radio signal. So how low can you go? That's a darn good question. Yeah. You can go up to kilohertz, megahertz, and that's the HF bands. You can go up to VHF, UHF, SHF, EHF. EHF starts at 30 gigahertz and goes up. That's EHF, extremely high frequency, 30 gigahertz and up. A buddy of mine was doing work with RF circuits at 600 gigahertz in the late 1968 area and time frame. The man who was the chief scientist of the company I was working for was doing 600 gigahertz work. There is a millimeter and submillimeter electronics that you can buy from the Militech company that goes up to something like 1 or 2 terahertz. That's 1 or 2,000 gigahertz. Okay. When you're up at that higher frequency, you're in the far, far infrared region. In all these cases, as I go up the spectrum, the higher and higher frequencies, the wavelength gets shorter, the frequency gets higher, and whether or not you call it light is strictly a function of whether or not your eye responds to it. We all know what 600 megahertz means. 650 megahertz is a little bit higher than the 432 band, but lower than the 902 ham band, 902 megahertz ham band. So we know what 600 megahertz is. If I take a 600 megahertz transmitter
at 8 o'clock
and change it in such a way that the frequency is 1 million times higher than 600 megahertz, you do that, and you're in the middle of the optical band. You're looking around the room right now with your eyes, and they're operating at a frequency roughly a million times higher than 600 megahertz. That gives me a feel for where it is. And so if my antenna could put out a significant signal at a million times higher than 600 megahertz, and I looked at that antenna, it would look a little bit like your flashlight. You would think you're looking at a light bulb. Mother Nature makes no difference between light and radio and millimeter and microwave and whatever. It's just a difference in wavelength and a difference in frequency. But the signal itself is the same. Maybe that helps a little bit. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, very good. Yeah, and the second part of this question is, where exactly do microwaves begin? Well, we assume that microwaves begin at 1,000 megahertz, or I get anything, or wavelength, anything less than 30 centimeters, I would assume it's still considered the beginning of microwave. So we correct it?
That's the current definition. Not too many years ago, a couple of decades ago, anything higher than 100 megahertz was considered microwave. When, I'm trying to think of his name now, Ed Tilton, W1CER, I think was his call letters. All of a sudden I can't think of Ed Tilton's call letters. He's the man who invented the world above 50 megacycles. That article that's in every issue of QSC magazine for the last 50 years. What's his call letters? Okay, I should know Ed Tilton's call letters. Because the Ed Tilton Yagi was the first...
Q.
What was that again?
1HDQ.
That's him, W1HDQ. The first Yagi I ever built was the 13-element Ed Tilton 432 megacycle Yagi, 1971. First Yagi I ever built was an Ed Tilton. He's the man who invented the world above 50 megs. He's the man who made sure I got an award because of that article I put in QSC magazine called the Parallel Kilowatt Stripline Amplifier for 432 megacycles, way back in 1972. He was the reviewer of that article. And he and I had a nice sit-down conversation at Newington, Connecticut around that period of time. I got called up there for a visit. They wanted to see the man that built that particular transmitter. They wanted to make sure it wasn't a nut paper, I'm guessing. Anyhow, when he first came out with his series of articles, it was called On the Ultra Highs. Anything above 30 megacycles was considered ultra-high frequency in the late 40s when he invented that series of articles on the ultra-highs, which eventually became the world above 50 megacycles. So whatever frequency you're familiar with, something that's higher than that at each point in time is called microwave or ultra-high or Never Never Land or whatever. So for a good period of time, it was 100 megs, then it was 300 megs. Now most people agree microwave begins at 1,000 megs. I think it won't be too long from now when microwave will be anything above 3,000 or 10,000. It depends on what you're familiar with. I can now buy transistors that can put out 50 watts. at 10,000 megacycles. So 10,000 megacycles, when I first got on that band in 1990, it was damn difficult to get there. And generating solid-state transistors of anything more than 200 milliwatts was very difficult. Now I can buy 50-watt transistors and beyond. And so it's becoming so common that the day will come and that's going to be considered microwave. So it's